This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series. Okay, welcome back, everybody. This is the point of the evening where I get to torture our two readers by asking them impossible questions, or not, as the case may be. Joel, let's start with you. The bit that you read of the book was a very personal thing for the character, presumably your main character. So we didn't get to see much of the world. Would you like to fill us in a little bit on the setting of the books?
Yeah, the books are kind of set in this world that I developed over the course of about 10 years because I grew up with four siblings and we grew up telling each other stories of these dinosaurs and penguins and dragons who all had adventures in this strange world they lived in. And I developed it into this more complicated fantasy world. And eventually when I was about 16, I decided I wanted to write them down as novels. And so the world developed out of that, and we had maps and family trees and all these complex geopolitical relations between the different countries and the different, you know, sentient species. So you have these kind of human-penguin hybrids called the Pengs, who have an empire. And this was something I really enjoyed making. And the Pengs are quite prominent in The Sky Slayer. The book starts in a prison that is run by the Pengs. And the thing about the Pengs is that they're a very ridiculous concept. Who's going to take penguins seriously as an empire? So I decided I'm going to take them seriously as an empire. And so I developed this, that they have a very powerful empire and that everybody treats them very seriously. And I thought that, because I thought if I treated them like a silly thing, oh, they're just penguins, that would get very old very quickly. So I thought, I've got to give them like a serious edge to them. They've got a serious history, a serious culture and backstory, and there are factions and dynasties. And in this book, it explores the Imperial Pengs, who are part of the Empire, and the Renegade Pengs, who are fighting against it, and how they both have very different ideologies that are both kind of leaning on Pengs are the superior beings. And the Empire believes we are superior, therefore we must spread our brilliant culture and ideals to the world. And the Renegades say, no, we are superior, we must keep everybody out, and we must keep ourselves fenced in. And so there's a lot of tension going on there. And so, yeah, the world, there's a pair of maps in this book that Hazel Butler edited for us, because I have a map that is quote-unquote to scale, in that I have a scale, so I can work out how long it should take them to get to places. But that resulted in the world having a lot of empty ocean space, which Hazel very artistically made a lot less empty. The world existed first, and then like the novels came out of me putting stories and characters into this world. As a result, like because I've kind of lived in this world in my head for so long, it's very easy for me to jump into stories in this world. I mean, I'm doing a novella set in the same world for NaNoWriMo at the moment, which has been just, I've just like flown through the word count really, really quickly because I know the setting, I know the characters, I know the world. Whereas like previously I'd been writing a new novel that was set in Helsinki in modern day, and that was a struggle. Even though I know Helsinki quite well, I've been there quite a lot, it was bizarre going into a known world, a real world rather than a world I was essentially making up as I went along, but kind of had all of this baggage going with it. I feel like I've rambled a bit on this.
You've given me several jumping off points for further questions. But we've got to start with the penguins. Lovecraft, of course, had giant penguins as scary monsters in At the Mountains of Madness, but Lovecraft seemed to be scared of everything. So. I'm afraid the first thing that came to my mind when you said you had an empire of penguins was that the emperor would be played by Burgess Meredith and he'd have an evil laugh. Which, you know, that's just me being bad. But obviously the thing that I have to ask you is about Helsinki, because we'll probably have a few Finns listening in on the podcast and they'll want to know what on earth you are doing in their city and whether you're coming to Worldcon.
Yes, I am coming to Worldcon. Helsinki, I know a lot of people in Helsinki. I was part of a discussion forum since about 2002 called the Barrow Downs, which was a Tolkien Lord of the Rings discussion forum. And I met some of my all-time like best friends through that forum. And quite a few of them lived in Helsinki. And so, as you know, we got to know each other very, very well. And eventually we decided, let's have a big gathering where we all meet together, and we call them moots, like an Ent moot in Lord of the Rings. So these were Barrowdown's moots. And so we went to Finland moot was the first one, where we all, there was about 20 or so of us, and we all piled into their tiny flat in Helsinki. And but then every year since then, you know, in more reasonable numbers, we've been going back and forth between Helsinki and the UK. And yeah, it's a lovely city. I really like it. It's cold. It's wet. But as someone from the north of the UK, I kind of appreciate that. But yeah, so like, when I came to write this new story, currently titled Hollower, which is about a young girl who has magic powers, and the magic powers depend on her memories, that every time she uses magic, she loses a memory. And it deals with identity and the idea of, you know, you are the sum of your memories, and as you lose them, you become a different person. And I really struggled with the setting for it, because I wanted it to be in the modern world. I tried setting it in London, but it didn't feel right, because everything's set in London, and London's really boring. I tried setting it in Manchester, but I don't know Manchester that well, even though it's, you know, an hour on the train from me. So I thought, I'll go to Helsinki. A, Helsinki's weird and interesting, and B, it's got really nice set pieces, so... And it gives me a really good excuse to go to Helsinki. I don't think my publisher is going to pay my expenses to go to Helsinki to research this book. But yeah, it's a beautiful city. And I'm not being paid by the Helsinki Tourist Board. But if they do want to send me money, I have a PayPal.
You don't need an excuse to go to Helsinki. And just in case anybody's worried, it's absolutely beautiful in August. Lovely time of year. But let's give Jessica a turn now. I noticed as you were reading through it that you made mention of steam-driven carriages and giant steam engines. So does this series have a sort of steampunk feel to it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I thought it might be steampunk. I think it's probably steampunk fantasy, because I think it's... I mean, now I've come across some real steampunk, as it were. I mean, some of the other writers with Crystal Ink are steampunk, and I realise that technology... I mean, it's almost like the technology in my stories is just part of the background. I mean, it was interesting listening to what Joel said, because my world grew up slightly the other way round, in that I had the characters, and then the world grew up around them, I mean, quite slowly. And for a long time, I wanted to set it in, you know, this world. But it increasingly became clear that that just wasn't going to be possible, particularly because I had got France slightly stretched, I realised. So, and also things weren't quite in the right place, too. You know, they were sort of too fast. So, in the end, and it made more sense for it to be an alternate world, because I could then do things with religion, which don't appear, for instance, so much in the first chapter, but, for instance, the version of Christianity that's the doxoi actually isn't really Christianity at all, because it's actually the Virgin Mary is God. So there are all these little twisty bits in it. So I suppose it's like steampunk, but it's also a bit earlier. I mean, I suppose one of the things about steampunk is it's all to do with, you know, I mean, it's things like the difference engine, you know, whereas I think in this case, the technology is just there. I mean, I do remember when I originally wrote this, I did research things like how to drive a steam train, which there's a wonderful book called How to Drive a Steam Train. I can't remember who wrote it, actually, so I can't give an attribution. But it was very good, but and I sadly haven't yet managed to drive a steam train myself, but it was quite helpful, so I hope I didn't make too many terrible boo-boos. But does that answer your question?
If you've got a scene in there of somebody driving a steam train, that pretty much guarantees that my boyfriend's going to buy it. Hello, Kevin, darling. Hope you're okay. I think that's you know, steampunk fantasy was what it kind of sounded like, and perhaps it's set earlier than most steampunk, so that explains why all the steam-driven computers haven't developed yet. So I'd stick to the steampunk stuff for you, because I don't know whether anybody else heard, but on my radio show last week, I had a couple of ladies who are setting up the Bristol Steampunk Museum, which will be a shop as well, and it'll be all sorts of exciting steampunky stuff, including selling books. So I'm sure that if you've got steam engines in your book, then and they will be wanting to sell it, and Joe will provide. So that's the steampunk angle for it. What are all the Russians doing in France? Is this some sort of reworking of the Napoleonic Wars?
No, it's not the Napoleonic Wars. I'm afraid that's another thing. I mean, it was an idea about refugees. I mean, it started out, I think, in the very beginning, I thought I had a post-apocalyptic world. But then I think the idea was, or is, that there's been an ice age, a mini ice age, and parts of Europe got very cut off from other parts. And then the moment there was a thaw, everybody went, help, and migrated south at great speed. So really, there are two big empires which you hear about. There's something called the Neustrian or Neustrian Empire, which is based on the name of a real empire and kind of involves bits of France and Germany. But that's really ceased to exist because of the Great Cold. And then there's a Russian-type empire called the Sklaven Empire, which basically covers most of Eastern Europe and quite a bit of Western Europe as well, right as far as Hungary and things. And that's ruled over by a despot called the Stariet, who's a bit like a czar, basically, but he's kind of all-powerful and a bit mean. So it's all set in this rather fragmented version of France, where things are gradually starting to come back. And it's the sort of the main kicking off point is Massalia, which is based on Marseille. And what's happening is that these Russians and French people who are called the Frange are gradually building a railway inwards back into the interior, which they're rediscovering. And that they get to a certain point. And I think I conceived of it as being a bit like these films where somebody reaches the frontier and then runs into trouble. So they're building a railway under a forest, and they fall foul of the local deity, who then proceeds to wreak havoc for the next few books, I would say, you know.
Well, if they're building a railway into France from Marseille, presumably that's going up through the Rhone Valley, which is where the TGV line goes, when you actually catch the TGV from Paris to Barcelona, which I did a couple of weeks ago. So I've actually been along that route. It's absolutely beautiful, because you've got the foothills of the Alps on the eastern side of it. So it's a fabulous setting. And all these sort of outcroppings of hills with little castles on them. Is that what you have in mind?
I mean, yes, I suppose so. I mean, I did actually go there many, many years ago. And in fact, I haven't really been back since that much. But it was sort of partly based on a real village, which is called La Gare d'Adémar. And it's in the Rhone Valley. But the only slight problem is that the nearest thing is a very large nuclear power station. In reality, so you can see from the village, I actually saw a film a few years ago where people were having lunch at a restaurant and there was this huge nuclear power station by the banks of the Rhone. So, but as it's an alternate version, it doesn't matter so much. But yes, it's absolutely that, it's that railway line. I did try emailing the mayoral whatever, I don't know, the mayor's office in Gare d'Adémar, but I didn't get a reply, and they probably thought this woman is complete loony. I haven't tried again, because I've just written a story about what? No, but yes, it's set in a real place, but not.
Yeah, Kevin and I were spotting nuclear power stations as the train was speeding up through France. There are several of them along the way, I think. Anyway, let's come back to Joel briefly now. I got the impression, just listening to you, that there were one or two spoilers in that for book one.
I mean, yeah, kind of. I tried to write them all as kind of standalone, so in the second book I kind of have to explain stuff that happened in the first one that other people can sort of very quickly grasp. I think that if somebody starts with the Sky Slayer and then wants to go back to the first book, The Sea Stone Sword, while they may know the ultimate ending and a couple of little details. I think that what I hope is the more interesting part is the why and the emotional journey the character goes on. We're currently beginning the process of having an audiobook made of the Seastone Sword with the very brilliant Genevieve Savayan, who will be doing the reading, and she has got absolutely fantastic voices. And part of that has kind of reminded me of the kind of emotional journey that the character goes on. So I think that there's a lot in the Seastone Sword. It's not just about the quest. I mean, one of the ongoing themes of the series is this phrase that's the quest is not the quarry, the quest is the quest, which Doctor Who fans might recognise that phrase from a very underrated Tom Baker story. But it's a phrase that I really like. It's that the destination isn't the point of the quest. The quest is the quest. It's about the relationships between the various characters, some of whom die, and some of whom apparently die, and some of whom survive. And it's more about the quest in itself rather than the ultimate destination.
Ah, so some of those people that we were told are dead in that section might not really be dead. Ah, right. Okay. The other thing I wanted to say is I gather you have a podcast. Would you like to tell us all about it?
Yeah, I'm on the Grimcast, which is the podcast for Grimbold Books. We do it partly for our Patreon page, patreon.com/Grimbold Books. Little plug there. Every month we talk to people in the biz. We talk about publishing, about writing, about books. We've done an episode generally about Grimbold Books itself. We did an episode about the workings of an independent publisher, where Joe was one of the guests there. We've just done an episode about artists, which included Ken Dawson, who is one of our brilliant authors, brilliant artists, who did the cover design, although not the cover art of my books. And also Josh Corner, who is my brother, who does these little comic strips called Grim and Bold, which are ridiculous, about these two little cats who have just stupid adventures. So we do that podcast, and we've got another episode about marketing coming out in December, where we talk to a professional marketing person, man. And in January, exciting news, we have Becky Chambers, author of The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet and A Close and Common Orbit, will be talking to us about self-publishing versus traditional publishing. So, yeah, and I also work for the Science Fiction and Fantasy Network, and I do interviews with various authors from all over the spectrum, and those are on sciencefictionfantasynetwork.com. That's my plug. Do I get paid now?
Yeah, well, somebody might buy you a pint of beer or something like that. Jessica, when you started out and the old lady said, it's the end of civilization as we know it. You wrote that so long ago and you're reading it now. How prescient were you?
Well, it's rather worrying, actually. Yes, I mean, it was never going to be dystopian fantasy because I don't think I'm brave enough. But it really is starting to get a bit look like it is the end of civilization. You know, I mean, you kind of think, well, what's going to happen next? You know, I mean, first of all, we get Brexit, and then, you know, well, I say first, I mean, apart from all people dying off, but it's starting to feel a bit pre-apocalyptic at the moment.
Your books are reissues, so obviously they're all written and whatever. So can you tell us? In that case, yes. So they're not all written. So can you tell us what we're actually going to be getting and maybe a rough publication schedule?
Okay. Well, what it is, there were two that were previously published back a very long time ago in 2001 and 2002. And then I self-published the third one. And then Grimbold and Crystal Ink are bringing all four out. And starting in January, and I'm going to touch wood, with Children of the Shaman. And I think the idea is, if this is right, that they're to come out every 3 months thereafter. So the first two are Children of the Shaman and The Glass Mountain. They're the ones that are coming round again. Then there's Malarat, which I self-published. And I've been editing it because it was a ginormous book, and it's still a ginormous book, but I got rid of a lot of it because I kept thinking, no, no, masses of padding, chop, chops, and it got a bit sort of too much, and I ended up with sort of nothing but verbs in the end and had to put a few bits back, you know, like, I don't know, nouns and things. But and then the fourth one is Winterbloom, which is the most recent one, and that's the one that's actually partly set in this world. And I did some rather naughty things with Bath and indeed with Stonehenge. I mean, and then I keep feeling quite embarrassed about it and thinking, oh, how could you do that with... So, I mean, but it was good fun to do that. It was quite nice to do something based in the local area, and I was able to go and do some quite funny site inspections, like the... I discovered that the place I'd chosen, which is number 13, the circus, is actually a dentist's. So I was able to get inside and have a look. And I think they must have wondered. I sent them an email asking if I could inspect it, and they sort of didn't reply. And in the end, Steve and my husband sort of said, well, why don't you just go round? And so I did, and they said, oh, yes. And then they showed me the basement, which was very gratifying. So I was able to alter a few things because I got the basement the wrong way round, which would have been embarrassing, although probably only customers of the dentist would actually know that.
I'm glad you told me that you were doing strange things to Bath the week after I met the mayor, so I don't have to tell him all about it. Jo, you had some things to say.
Yeah, just going off what Jessica said about... she sent us Winterbloom for our open submissions, and I read it. I was like, I really, 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 really like this. Really good. But she had sent it in saying that it was a standalone. And when I read it, it was blatantly apparent that it wasn't a standalone. And I went to Sammy and I was like, I really, really, really like this, but I want all the rest of them as well. Can we do that, please? And Sammy said, okay. So always, you know, send things for open subs because you never know what's going to happen.
Okay. Has anybody else got any questions for any of our readers? Oh, Joe's got a question.
Yeah, this is one for Joel. Now, Joel, you're dyslexic, so how have you found that with your writing? Has it been a challenge, and how did you overcome it?
Dyslexia is not really something you ever overcome. It's something you learn to deal with. I grew up in a kind of environment where dyslexia was kind of associated with being stupid. I had a lot of very unhelpful teachers in primary school, especially, who were kind of like, oh, don't bother with reading and writing. That's not really going to be your area. Focus on something different, you know. And, you know, there is a kind of a common theme of people with dyslexia tend to go more into the arts, but more into sort of drawing and music. And I can't draw to save my life, as my brother Joshua will tell anybody. And I can't play a musical instrument, as my elder brother Matthew will tell anyone. And I always felt like I wanted to create these worlds, write these stories. And for a long time, I kind of assumed that I would write an outline of what these stories would be like and, you know, explain what the characters were, and then somebody more talented would come along and write it properly. I think even up until the point where I was sending out a submission of the Seastone Sword to Crystal Link, I was thinking, yeah, but they want someone better, someone like a proper writer to write it properly, you know. And it still to this day goes through my head, like, oh, someone proper will come and write this properly one day. And, you know, eventually you get to the point where, okay, nobody is going to do that. I'm going to have to do it myself. Oh, dear. So, yeah, I ended up going to university doing English and creative writing, partly to kind of say... maybe it's because there was a slightly anti-authoritarian streak in me that said, well, they're saying, you can't do this, don't do this, and I'm going to say, I'm going to do it anyway. Which doesn't mean it wasn't a struggle. It is still a struggle. And a lot of it is kind of bound up with issues of anxiety. Like, I cannot, for the life of me, write something without a spell check. I have a panic attack. It's so bound up with how I was brought up, and a lot of my schooling was kind of being... unable to spell, being unable to read quickly, being stumbling over words and things as you're reading was associated with being stupid. And so that came with a lot of stigma that took a lot of time to get over, and it's still something I struggle with, that, you know, it kind of makes you feel lesser. There was a friend of mine who was also dyslexic who was talking about how when you're dyslexic and you make a spelling error, it really hits you. Whereas anyone else who makes a spelling error, oh, it's just a mistake, I'll just change it, Whereas for people who are dyslexic, it often feels like, no, this isn't just a mistake, this is something intrinsic, this is something that is kind of like a part of my personality. And when that has been kind of associated for so long with, well, that's a social faux pas, you can't be illiterate, you can't be unable to read and write, you know, that really messes you up as a kid. It is something I still struggle with, and it's something I still fight against. But I feel that every book I get published is a minor victory and a little middle finger to Mrs. Wright, my Year 6 teacher, who told me she didn't. She one time told me she didn't bother marking some of my work because she knew I wouldn't spell anything right. So, you know. So, yeah, if you write for no other reason, write out of spite. That is my...
Yes, well, do I write out of spite? Yeah, I'm not going to answer that question. Has anybody else got any questions for our readers? Oh, yes, Joel.
Have you read The House of Shattered Wings by Aliette de Bodard? It is also set in a kind of alternate France, is what I was wondering.
I haven't, but now I want to. I'm quite interested. This is a terrible confession. I'm very, very bad at reading. I wish I read a lot more, but it's almost like every now and every few months I have a brief spate. And I noticed that there was another book, I think also by Aliette de Bodard, that I wanted to read. But now I'm sort of, ooh, so I will.
I was just saying, I did an interview with her a while back, and she's really, really nice.
Yeah, Aliette's lovely. I'm very fond of her and a great writer. All this talk of France reminds me that the 2018 Eurocon, so that's not next year, the one afterwards, is going to be in Amiens in northern France. So it's relatively easy to get to by train. You take the Eurostar to Brussels, change at Lille onto a local service. And one of the interesting things about Amiens is it's the place where Jules Verne settled when he was an adult. And he had a house there and wrote most of his novels there. And I believe it's possible to go on a tour of this little Jules Verne museum that they have there. So you need to tell Sammy that you have to have a Crystal Link expedition to Amiens to sell Jessica's books to the French. So I think that's all of our questions. We're now down to announcements. And I guess, Joe and or Tom, you want to say something?
Yes, this, as many of you may know, I dramatically quit at BristolCon, and one of the things I am quitting is the Fringe, but it's all right because it's going to be in very safe hands because Tom is going to take it over and he has incredibly dramatic plans for the Fringe, which I will let him tell you about.
When Jo says quit, what she means is that she's leaving Bristol. She's going to flee into the Welsh marshes and set up a resistance movement, and train people to shoot longbows and all that sort of stuff.
We're all going to follow you in the next coming months. So, it was... Well, I think of it as an enormous privilege to continue with BristolCon Fringe, and as a white, cis, straight male, I know one or two things about privilege, so I managed to... deal with that quite quickly, it's a big task, and I think I'm taking my responsibilities seriously. So hopefully, you know, day to day, you know, Cheryl will still be hosting, and hopefully to our listeners and the people who graciously come and join us in the pub, there won't be too much of a change, but it will just hopefully just continue on its path of. Being an excellent podcast and an excellent evening. And yes, I'll just go back to lurking in the shadows. All right, thank you.
Okay. Any other announcements before we close down? In which case, thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Joe has an announcement.
Just one quick one. The pub night is in here next week. As usual, it's the last one before Christmas, so I might bring mince pies.
Alrighty. Well, thank you to Joel and Jessica. And there is no Fringe in December, so we will be reconvening again in January, where Amanda Huskis and one other to be confirmed. See you then.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.